Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
A Living History production.
I'm Peter Hart.
And I'm Gary Bain.
And together we're Pete and Gary's Military History
Podcast. Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Gary Bain and I'm here at my home with the lovely Peter Hart.
Hello, Gary.
And it's the new year.
It is. Bright and early it is, isn't it?
It is, although when you hear this, it's probably going to be about February.
Yeah, but there you go.
Oh, well, that died a death, didn't it?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Oh, should we pack up then?
Yeah.
No! Onwards!
What are we doing today?
Well, we're doing another episode of the 5T Forefars, our favourite second 5 and 4-4 year in memory. And this one's called All Over Bar the Shouting. But there's something important in this. What is it, Gary?
Is it a question mark?
It is, because people tend to think that, you know, when they're advancing into Germany, it's all over bar the shouting. But people are still getting killed, still getting maimed. It's still pretty awful if you're there and amidst it.
Yeah, although I think, in fact, it's fair to say both sides seem to have lost their enthusiasm for a war that was, as you rightly say, ending soon, but might outlive them.
Yeah, absolutely. They know people are going to die. They're just, what's their main hope? You are an ex-soldier. What would the average soldier be thinking?
Well, that it's not me. It's someone else.
Gets horribly wounded or killed. Yeah, absolutely. Now, in the background, by 10th of April 1945, the 12th Army Group had subjugated the economic powerhouse of the Ruhr. Now Montgomery, that's 21st Army Group, and Bradley would launch a concerted drive for the Elbe, the River Elbe area, with the British edging north towards Hamburg. I didn't understand any of that, did you?
Yeah, the British are going to edge north towards Hamburg.
Oh, right. It all becomes
now, brilliant. For many of the men, this was a depressing period. It's a bit like the period I've known you.
Yeah.
The 2nd, 5th and 4th Far Yeomanry remained at Esbjerg for a couple of days as there was considerable concern over the proximity of the Belsen concentration camp.
Yeah, it was just about 10 to 15 miles to the northeast. This is terrible, of course. There were 40,000 emaciated inmates in there. The camp was only designed for about 8,000. Many of the people who'd survived had typhus. There were some 10,000 unburied corpses. This is a serious hell. Besides the human tragedy, which we're not brushing aside, although we're about to brush it aside by saying this is a serious health hazard to...
Yeah, and I didn't know this. This is rather bizarre, really. It triggered negotiations where the Germans claimed their only concern was that the inmates might spread the disease widely. And in the end, a limited neutral zone was granted immediately around the camp.
Now, there is a more cynical view of what was going on.
Yeah, well, if you think about it, in view of what was found there, the German authorities were really only intent on gaining time to hide their crimes against humanity.
Yeah. Now, whatever the case, and we know what we think, the men of the 2nd 5th 4th Yeomanry had to institute some basic precautions. And this is what Trooper Jack Edwards of B Squadron said.
We were issued with insect powder because of this camp where typhus was raiding. We didn't know it was Belsen at the time. We were told to sprinkle inside our clothing and inside our blankets. I couldn't have a bath, but we had a canvas bucket and I filled it with some water and got undressed and had a wash down. As I got dressed, I sprinkled this insect powder inside my shirt, pants and uniform as I redressed. I also sprinkled some inside my three blankets.
What is that DDT? I don't know what it is. It's
No, I don't know.
Now, the River Isle is in front of them, and the bridge had been demolished by the Germans, but the Royal Engineers, let's play tribute here to the Royal Engineers. We'll never do a project on them now. It's too late. But fantastic work they did. They bridged. They soon built a new bridge. And Vincent on de Alla, that's a town of Winton, which is on the River Alla, Gary, had been captured by the 15th, 19th Hussars and the Cheshire Regiment. And the 54 Fars resume their advance on the 15th of April. And they take it in turns with the Hussars to go first to lead the advance, don't they?
They do. Occasionally, there'd be a brisk exchange of fire, but nothing seriously impeded their progress as a regiment, although some tanks were knocked out of action. When they were leading, if in any doubt, as usual, they would blaze away at the hedges and woods that surrounded them. But at first, progress was quick.
Yeah. Brassing up, they called that, didn't they? Brassing up. And this is Captain Steele Brownie, Headquarters A Squadron. We went flat out through thick woods, firing ahead and to the flanks, occasionally seeing a few enemy and booby traps. Panzerfaust tied to trees with their tripwires across the road. Ineffective. The usual pall of smoke rose behind us. That's from all the firing. And they fired at anything that was going.
Now, they did encounter some serious opposition at Volthausen, which lay on the main Saltau Cellar Road.
And again, this is Steele Brownie. We met a roadblock. The Herefords dismounted to make an assault, and I went round to the left to find a good fire position. From here, I blazed away with HE, high explosive, and tracer to help the infantry forward, and the attack went in, past a wrecked roadblock and into the blazing street. I followed, ploughing through the burning debris. At one point, the house on my left collapsed and showered the tank with embers. I got out and kicked away anything that might have set fire to our precious possessions. possession. The bedding. Stowed on the back of the tent. The Herefords, with our close support, forced the defenders to retreat. But a few snipers were left. They killed or wounded several of the infantry, and we tank commanders docked up and down to present as small a target as possible, while still seeing what was going on. We could not pinpoint the snipers, but we were able to identify the area from where their fire was coming from. It was decided to burn them out. Tom Heald and I crashed through the gardens, surrounded the offending area, and poured in maximum fire till within about 10 minutes all the houses were ablaze. The snipers were silent. House-to-house fighting like that in Waldhausen was always exhilarating. Imminent danger from any direction and the closeness of the destruction caused by one's own guns. Wow.
I mean, that's incredibly descriptive, isn't it?
Yeah.
Now, the advance resumed until they reached the village of Beckerdorf. And once more, you're going to tell us what Captain Steele Brownlee said.
Shots were fired at the leading tanks by troops dug in on the fields. Fire was returned. They fell silent, but made no sign of surrender. So Tom Heald got among them with his troop. Still no response, so he got out and hauled a few from their trenches, which was taking a chance. You're not kidding.
Well, they could have posed a real threat had the German soldiers not proved to be broken men who had more than they could take of the war.
Yeah, and we'll make this clear again. This is this group of German soldiers.
Yeah, not all Germans.
Not all Germans, but this group had had enough. And this is what Lieutenant Thomas Heald, 2 Troop A Squadron, said.
Suddenly, two hands appeared out of the ground. Looking at it, we realised this ploughed field was full of slit trenches. This was obviously somebody wanting to surrender. Well, there was some of our infantry about, but I couldn't persuade them to do anything about it. So I got out and hauled this poor chap, who was a 17-year-old Hungarian, out of the ground and put him on the tank. So I drove the tank over the trenches, really to frighten people. I made quite sure the tracks were on either side of the trenches. The infantry followed and got them out of the ground. That's how we got 70 or 80 prisoners.
Now, Steel Brownlee, he's also involved, and he liberates a group of slave workers. And he's enormously proud and satisfied of what he's achieved here. And this is what we, I mean, the current army, you know the thing about making a difference, soldiers making the difference. And he really feels he's made the difference. There is there's something coming up that shows another side of being a soldier. But this is what he said. Near the farm where I was sitting was a sort of barbed wire cage surrounding a hut. I broke down part of the fence and was amazed to find over a dozen men and women of various nationalities, some French, ragged and living in squalid conditions. They were slave workers who'd been there for 2 or 3 years. Wow. And they belonged to the farmer, who locked them in at the end of each day's work. They then ate what was passed to them through the wire. I got all this out of them, astonished at their casual and matter-of-fact description of their lot. They were totally dispirited and submissive, but I felt quite otherwise. I hauled out the farmer and his family and made them tear all the wire down. No tools allowed. The ex-slaves sat and watched, smoking our cigarettes after eating a hot meal from our rations, and visibly came alive again. And that's, again, I found that a very powerful quote from Steel. I love Steel Brownlee's accounts. They're not from an interview I did. They're from his own personal account. What a man he was. Anyway.
Now, after they crossed the New Muiden Bridge, they headed off north to Poitzen.
I just want to say, in the book, Burning Steel, there's quite a lot about what happened when they crossed the Muiden. We haven't got time for everything. I want to make it clear, there's lots of action going on that we haven't got time to cover. Carry on, sorry. Carry on. I do apologise, Gary.
Now here, Steel Brownlee and Tom Hild were ordered forward to make sure the next wood was clear so as to assist the 23rd Hussars, who were taking over the lead role. Now this, as you sort of alluded to, triggered a tragic incident. Well, and this is what Captain Steel Brownlee had to say.
This is an awful, awful crime. And you can imagine, he's felt so good that morning, and then this. He says this. The wood was about half a mile away astride the road. A German half-track had just emerged from it and had been destroyed. We had no infantry, so the best tactic was to go flat out and circle the wood just out of Panzerfaust range. All quiet. I got permission to go further and had a good view of a smaller wood to the right. There were movements and 2 tiny white dots appeared at ground level, evidently men in slit trenches. I put in 4 or 5 HE and then a stream machine gun. The place took fire. Figures emerged waving white cloths, and I motored nearer. To my horror, they were civilians, followed by a horse and cart on which were piled all kinds of household goods. I halted 100 yards from them, not knowing what else to do. 2 figures came towards me. They were children, a boy and girl, holding hands and running as hard as they could over the rough ploughed earth. They came right up to the tank, looked at me, and the small boy said in English, "You have killed my father." There was nothing I could say. The only thing to do was to get on with the job. Now, I remember that is incredibly... That's the other side of being a soldier. He hadn't done it deliberately, but he had killed that boy's father.
So in a single day, he'd gone from liberating slave labourers to killing innocent civilians. And it was just a few hours. It's a cruel war.
And he hadn't done it deliberately. It was an accident. But then if you're firing machine guns and high explosive.
Now, he didn't know it, but Steel Brownlee's war was almost over. Now, with Tom Hild following up, he decided to check the woods were clear before wazing through the 23rd Hussars for the next leg of the advance.
Now, there, he gets into the... And they find an abandoned... Well, the crew are nearby, but they surrender straight away. It's a 75mm anti-tank gun. And Steel Brownlee, he's cheered up a bit, but then that's the nature of soldiers. He decides to try and destroy it. And let us hand over to Trooper John Buchanan, 4 Troop A Squadron. That's... his old gunner, I think, wasn't it? To see what happens next.
Brownlee had a look. He said, "I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll get a shell and we'll stick it down the muzzle. Get well back, then you fire at it. You can turn the machine gun to single action. Pop, pop, until I hit it. And that would blow it up." That was the idea. So we stuck a shell in it. He stood behind the tank. He had the telephone. "Right, Buck, fire." Bang! "No, you've missed it. A wee bit to the right." Bang! I should have waited for him, but before he could say "now," I put another bullet in. It hit it. The thing blew up and metal came back and smacked him right in the chest, about an inch of shrapnel, but it hit him square about half an inch deep into his chest. Naturally, he couldn't go on, so he was sent back.
And this is a beauty. That was oral history, that one. I remember doing it. But this is what Steel Brownie said in his memoir. A small piece of red-hot shell case hit me in the chest. Lying on my back, looking at the sky, I put my hand inside my shirt and threw the object away. Everything rather blurred. I found myself sitting on a petrol can and Mackenzie tying something tight round my chest. Soon I felt fine and was about to stand up when the medical officer appeared. The 23rd Hussars had passed through and their echelon was parked nearby. One of my crew had gone over to them and brought a doctor. He said I was all right, but added that, of course, I must be evacuated. I disagreed, but he insisted. If it had been our own doc, I am sure that he would have let me stay in the echelon for a day or two, at least to see how things went. As it was, within 5 minutes, I was in a jeep going back the way we had come. It was then in a three-tonner and comfortably to a dressing station, I think in Hermannsburg, in a large barn. A medical officer pronounced the wound clean and gave me a jab. Told me to wait for an ambulance going back. I sat down but began to bleed, so I lay on a stretcher. It was right he was sent back. What do I know? But
oh, it sounds it, doesn't it? And despite his protests, Steel Brownlee was now in the grip of a very efficient evacuation machine.
Too right.
And he was sent back to Brussels to recuperate.
He does rejoin them, but after the war, that's the end of his time. Now, it becomes routine, doesn't it? The three Allied groups are making good progress. Three Allied army groups, sorry. And of course, the Russians are fighting like mad to get Berlin. But what's it like for the second 54 fires?
Well, for them, it was a case of rapid advances. Then hold-ups at roadblocks or blown bridges, a brief flurry of action, and then a resumption in the advance.
Now, they suffer their final fatal casualty on the 19th of April. And it's very sad. Of course, why is it sadder than all the other casualties? I don't know, but it just seems sad. They were ambushed by a Panzerfaust team in the woods just west of the village of Sangenstedt. That's on the final approaches to the town of Winsen, close to the Elbe. Being the last casualty was?
Well, it's a distinction that everyone's going to want to avoid, isn't it?
And this is what Sergeant Roy Valance, 4 Troop A Squadron, says. The war was rapidly approaching its end, and one felt it would be unfortunate to catch it at the last moment. One thought, well, we've made it, almost. You didn't volunteer for anything. A friend of mine, Corporal Bush, he was killed. He'd gone right the way through from Normandy. I was just down the road. He was in the lead and he was ordered to cross a road. As he did, a German anti-tank gun fired down the road. He stopped and bailed out. The gun fired its second shot, an HE. It exploded and caught him and killed him. I helped to bury him. It was a very, very sad end.
Now that same day, Tom Hill had a lucky escape from the same fate when his troop was ambushed as it passed through some woods. And this is what Lieutenant Thomas Hill of 2 Troop A Squadron said. We were ordered to go along the road. We proceeded in the usual way. I was the first or second tank. Certainly, I was going at a reasonable speed, probably not too fast, probably firing, but I was hit by a bazooka. There was a flash, a big bang. I knew I'd been bazookaed. One's adrenaline starts running. I ordered, bazooka, driver, speed up. In fact, I was switched on to transmit, so the whole of the regiment heard I'd been bazookaed. We speeded up and got through the wood. The following tank got through, and I think there may have been one in front of me. When we could, we got out to see what had happened. The bazooka had hit the very end of the track pin. There was 10 or 12 inches of armour at that point. All it had done was explode on hitting and damage the track pin slightly. So, in fact, we weren't bazookaed properly. We were terribly lucky. If it had been 6 inches higher, it would have been at the base of the turret. I'm lucky Tom. Within half an hour, things had quietened down a bit. We got behind a farm building and the crew took the track off and put a fresh track pin in.
Well, lucky escape. Now, there's a welcome pause for regiment in the Winston sector. Why was that?
Well, the Elbe River was a considerable obstacle, and it would take a concerted effort to actually get across it.
And they're then withdrawn for a 10 days hard-earned rest behind the front line. And with that, we'll take a hard-earned rest for a couple of seconds.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary. Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to BOLLandBranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Now, on the 1st of May, they were on the move again, moving up to the Elbe, which had been crossed by their old friends in the 15th Scottish Division to form a bridgehead around Lauenburg.
Now, the Germans really are starting to give up the ghost. I mean, this is very late in the war now, 1st of May. And none of the men in their interviews, and this, I found this strange when I thought about it, because we did 50 interviews, none of them mentioned Adolf Hitler.
Yeah, because something happened the day before, didn't it?
Well, Adolf Hitler had committed suicide, and nobody mentioned it. But it's all good news, I suppose.
Yeah, that means peace is coming, doesn't it?
Yeah. So the 2nd 544, they're then ordered to race as fast as possible to cut off any and all German communications with the Jutland Peninsula. There was a battle there. Not quite.
What, the peninsula? Yeah. Now, initially, the regiment were following the 23rd Hussars and 8th Rifle Brigade, but in the early afternoon, they themselves took the lead.
Now, there's still some token exchanges of fire before they just surrendered. It's token now, though, and they're not suffering casualties. As we said, the last casualty was the 19th of April. What happens on the 2nd of May?
Well, their objectives then changed.
Ooh, what is it now?
Well, it was claimed that intelligence had been received that Lübeck civilians, worried by the imminent arrival of the Russians, had removed the demolition charges laid on the bridges and were eagerly awaiting the arrival of the British.
Now, this is part of this business of the Germans really were frightened of the Russians.
Now, the news triggered a near instantaneous response, and both the 2nd Fife and 4th Fire Yeomanry and the 23rd Hussars were ordered to proceed post-haste to Lübeck, and it led to something of a race.
What? The British Army racing...
Competition.
Competition.
Now, during that pell-mell advance, Tom Hill's troop was detached to relieve a party of some 1,600 RAF prisoners of war. They were actually reported to be at the village of Westerau, which was about 5 to 6 miles from Lübeck.
Now, they'd been in Stalag Luft 3, and they'd been on this terrible long march, and they were from the east, and they were in bad condition, weren't they? And this was an impromptu wired-up POW camp. It wasn't really a POW camp. It's just in a field outside the village. Now, Thomas Heald gives an account of what happened.
We drove up to the POW camp. The POWs had put the sign there. The camp was in a farm with a perimeter fence all the way around it. Strangely enough, none of them had heard the tanks coming. Therefore, they were quite unprepared. The guards opened the gate and we drove in. No resistance at all. Then we had 800 to 1,000 RAF men descend on our three tanks. Immediately we got there, there were then orders for us to return. Well, it's very difficult to extract oneself from 300 men on your tank. I found I was missing one tank.
Now, this is it, because this is the beauty of oral history. We interviewed Gordon Fidler, who was the driver of the missing comet, the missing tank. And he said this: we had to stop. The prisoners were coming out of the gate. They clambered onto the tank. It was absolutely horrendous. They put their arms around us. They were jumping onto the tanks. They wanted to ride on them. They wanted to get into the turret. They wanted to get into every part of the tank. We were taken inside the camp with barbed wire all the way around. They've got a meal of sorts, bits and pieces. So we all got out of the tanks and went into their mess room. Tom Heald went off with the guards. All of a sudden, we heard a tank start up. Somebody said to me, "Your tank's moving about out there." I rushed out there. The co-driver had been asked by the RAF prisoners if he would knock all the wire down. That was okay. He had no right to be in there, but he did it. And he did it all wrong. He went and followed the wire instead of going over it and back. Over it and back, knocking it down. When we got out there, the tank was absolutely covered with wire. All around the back sprockets, the idlers at the front. We were in a hell of a state. It took us 3 or 4 hours, using everything, to get the wire off the sprockets. So, in other words, because they kept going, it just wrapped.
Just wrapped itself, yeah. Now, meanwhile, the 2nd Fife and 4th Fire Yeomanry charged up the motorway.
Oh, that's...
The Autobahn, yeah, one of the cliched symbols of Hitler's Nazi regime, actually turned to good use. And they headed towards Lübeck.
Yeah. It's a really dramatic advance. And it triggered... There's lots of stories about this advance. This is one from Trooper... one of your favourites, Gary. Trooper Ron Forbes, 4 Troop B Squadron.
The Autobahn was a beautifully built road. It was elevated in certain parts. We were on one of these elevated parts when we saw this steam train leaving the station full of troops. We shot it up and blew up the engine. The personnel on the train all coming out and taking cover. 4 or 5 tanks line abreast tearing up that road, flat out. If you happen to have a better tank than your neighbour, well, you got ahead. It was very thrilling. You realised what the tanks could do on the Autobahn.
So they're racing.
Yeah.
Racing the 23rd Hussars and, of course, racing each other. Yeah. Now, this is quite amusing because it's not just trains they had a go at. What else did they have a go at?
Well, as far as they were concerned, planes were also a legitimate target.
Aeroplanes?
Yeah. And Trooper John Buchanan goes on to say, "We were coming into Lübeck and there was an aerodrome on the right-hand side. I saw a plane, a Junkers passenger plane, taking off. I fired at it, machine gun fire. I hit it, but what happened to it, I don't really know because it was a kind of foggy, misty sort of morning. I think it must have slewed or stopped."
So that's trains and planes.
Planes.
Now, what's next, do you think, Gary?
Well, in the mid-afternoon, they reached Lübeck to find the city wide open with no resistance.
Now, what's their first task? Lübeck's a port. What do they have to do?
Well, seize control of the bridges and docks. John Buchanan was delighted to add to his very own ship to his personal score as a gunner of various assorted German tanks, half-tracks, lorries, self-propelled guns and artillery.
You mean he fired at a ship? No. Hang on. You do the quote first. I'm just thinking of something.
This is what Trooper John Buchanan, 4 Troop, said. "We were sent down to the riverbank. No real purpose, and this ship was moving very slowly down the canal leading into the Baltic. The officer says, 'Fire a shot across his bow.' I think I fired an HE shell across his bow to make him stop. The damn thing didn't stop. 'Ah,' he says, 'brass it up. Shoot at it with the machine guns.' I got the machine gun onto the bridge and I really brassed it up. All the windows were shattered. Whoever it was must have turned the wheel because the ship veered away and crashed into the bank. The ship was stopped. It slewed across the canal. It would stop anything else. there was a ship added to my collection.
So that's trains and boats and planes. Dee-doo, dee-doo. Dee-doo, dee-doo. Dee-doo, dee-doo-doo.
Yes. Now, all the regiment were caught up in dealing with the swarms of prisoners. By and large, they were well treated.
And this is what Trooper Ron Forbes says.
There were prisoners all the time coming in. Most of them were bedraggled, unshaven, like tramps. There'd been days hiding. It was shocking to see what a proud army could be reduced to. Some of them were so young. They were just kids, really, 16 and that. They were crying and in complete fear. They'd been indoctrinated in that the British would shoot them. It must have been a great revelation to them when they realised that they were going to be treated fairly well.
Now, they're disarmed, of course, and they're gathered into pies, of roughly 1,000 each, and then they're sent off to improvised camps, like the Westerau camp, but for the Germans. How many are we talking about?
Well, in all, the regiment reckoned it dealt with some 15,000 German prisoners of war.
That is a definite case of 1, 2, 3 lots, isn't it?
Yeah. But then there's the problem of all the German civilian refugees that were pouring into the city seeking succour from the threat from the east.
What's that threat from the east?
That'll be the Russians.
Yeah, yeah. Because they're terrified of the Russians.
Now, at times, the rule of law collapsed as desperate civilians tried to get food from anywhere they could.
There's an even more serious present problem. And who can blame this lot, because they're the displaced persons camps. And they'd been enduring forced labour. They'd had terrible, terrible conditions. They'd been existing under the German jackboot, if you like. And how do you think they reacted to
Well, they weren't in any sort of mood to wait patiently for the authorities to make the proper arrangements. They wanted food now.
And what else did they want?
Well, some of them also wanted vengeance on any German that might be around.
And part of the duties is to try and control these people. It's a difficult task. It is difficult.
It is, but by the end of the 2nd of May, some degree of order had been achieved, and it was backed up by a really strict curfew.
Now, next day, the city's handed over to the 5th Division, and the regiment's then billeted for the next week in nearby villages of Monks Hagen and Eckhorst. They're just west of the city, just a couple of miles to the west of the city.
Now, the end of the war was nigh, and as so often happens, it ended in a tremendous anticlimax.
Well, for the five and four fires,
yeah. There was no heroic last battle. The German resistance, so long prolonged, had finally just fizzled out into a miasma of misery.
Miasma of alliteration again.
Yeah.
Purple prose.
You can't beat a bit of purple prose.
No. Well, sometimes. It's funny that there is always. I mean, I've done 3 of these regiment lists. You don't know about the DLI one yet, but it's always, of course, an anticlimax at the end, isn't it?
A formal military surrender was signed at 0241 on the 7th of May. Oh, 7th of May.
That's your birthday, Gary. Gary would like presents this year. Yes. If you could send them courtesy of Peter Hart.
With the final ratification of the unconditional German surrender to the Allies finally signed on the 8th of May at 21:20, so 20 past 9 at night.
So they celebrate it's victory in Europe, VE Day, 8th of May, and they celebrate with – how do they celebrate it?
Well, they had bonfires, they're drinking.
No, Gary, yeah, drinking.
And generally having a good time. It was a time for mixed feelings,
now,
really.
Explain to me why it's mixed feelings.
Well, as an individual, they're going to have relief that they'd survived and to finally know that they were safe. A natural celebration that their war was over. But at the same time, they're going to have a lingering sorrow for all the friends that they'd lost in the years since they'd landed in Normandy.
Yeah, and this is very evident in the interviews. I'd call it a kind of survivor's guilt. That's modern term. I don't think they use those terms then. But a survivor's guilt. Why have they survived when better men than they had died? It's a sort of cliched way of putting it, isn't it?
Yeah, it was as if all the weight pressing down on them had suddenly been removed and long-suppressed thoughts forced their way to the top. Such jumbled-up emotions in the military minds often promotes a desire to seek a happy or sad oblivion in alcohol.
Yes, and that's exactly what the men of the 2nd 545 Yeomanry did. And this is what Sergeant Roy Valance, our old favourite, 4 Troop A Squadron, said. Then it ended. We made a huge bonfire in the middle of a field. Believe it or not, the centre of it was a petrol tanker. They weren't entirely out of danger then. It wasn't absolutely full of petrol, but it still had some. Whatever else we could find, we put on it. A huge bonfire. We had it at night with a lot of beer. We fired off all our very pistols and whatever pyrotechnics we had. That was the end of it. I felt greatly relieved and extremely lucky. Lucky to have survived, Gary.
Now, Jeff Eason remembered a truly wild bonfire blazing out of control in that farmer's field at Monkshagen. And this is what Trooper Jeff Eason of the Recce Troop HQ Squadron says.
We were parked in the middle of a field. Celebrations are a bit difficult to arrange. We were up to our eyeballs in muck and mud. But we did tour the countryside and towed in 8 or 9 or 10 vehicles and piled them on top of a petrol tanker and set fire to the lot. The lads who'd been to Lübeck had got all this hooch from the bonded warehouse. They were all as tight as ticks. Anybody could have taken us then. I think I was the only sober bloke there. Now, this reminds me of my dear old father, Leslie Hart, who was in the Royal Navy at the time. And the only thing he ever told me, classic for an oral historian, about his war career was that when he was in Hamburg, he was put in charge for the docks to stop anybody looting the bonded warehouses. And he said he failed in his duty because guess who looted the bonded warehouses? The officers. Good old dad.
Yeah, and even, you know, with the 5th and 4th Fire Yeomanry, even the officers didn't stand on their dignity of their rank. And they too imbibed deeply. And this is Major Douglas Hutchison, Pinky Hutchison.
Pinky.
Of the RHQ squadron. I got drunk on some very unsuitable liquor. I did my drinking with the squadron. They produced this terrible liquor. It was quite potent stuff. I don't remember much else.
Love it. Love it. Now, what's the focus on here, Gary? What are we talking?
Well, booze, 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 and for a heroic few, even more booze.
Booze, booze. Did it matter what type of booze?
No, whatever it was, they drank it with gusto, and the results next day, you can well imagine. And this is Sergeant Jim Thompson Bell of C Squadron.
We celebrated with all the booze that we'd collected on the way. All different sorts in bottles. I said, what are we going to do? We had a big basin we found. We put it in there. It was nearly green. So he put all the drinks, all the bottles of drinks in it. So we mixed it. You name it, it was in it. We had some lighting units we picked up on the way belonging to the Germans. We set them up. We had a good old drink up. Then we went to sleep. We'd all bad heads. It was discovered in the morning that we couldn't find my driver, Smithy. We searched all around. We couldn't find him anywhere. About the second day, along comes this fellow with Smithy. He says, I think this is one of yours. I said, he's my bugger. Where have you found him? He said, well, he came to us in rather a bad state. He really only woke up this morning. Smithy looked a bit sheepish. What had happened? He went out of the barn to have a pee. I'm having a wee-wee. Yep. He turned the wrong way, didn't he? Till he landed up with these people down the road. Fortunately, they were English soldiers. And I think that disastrous tale of personal drunkenness of Smithy. And I like to make this a personal salute to Smithy.
Absolutely.
Now, we've been in that state. There are photographs of us after a Douglas Haig Fellowship leaning on a wall. Do you remember?
Yeah, and we missed the wall.
Basically.
Now, VE Day was a night to remember, celebrated in such a style that ironically ensured most of them couldn't actually remember it at all. And for them, their war was over.
The 2nd, 5th and 4th for Yeomanry.
So that must be the end of the podcast.
No, because there's one last episode, which is epilogue, which looks at how they get back into, well, a bit about the time of Germany in peacetime, but then demobilisation and how they got back into the civilian life. And I've just done some work on this, and I found this probably the most, I don't know, heartrending, sad episode of the lot. I don't know why. I found it, and I think you, dear listener, will find that it's not all a happy ending for everybody in the 5 and 4 5.
Well, I look forward to another episode in the exciting tales of the 5 and 4 5. I still can't say it. 5 and 4 5 Yeomanry. Yeah. 3rd Tank Regiment we could have had. Why? Cheers, Pete.
Cheers, mate. Thanks for listening to the show.
Blah, blah, blah.
If you'd like to support
blah,
us,
blah,
you can now buy us a coffee.
Blah, blah,
visit www.buymeacoffee.com/PGMH.
Or visit www.blahblahblahblahblah.
And we'd be jolly grateful.
Cheers. Thanks for listening. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook to learn more about each episode. And if you'd like to support the podcast, you have a couple of options. You can buy us a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/PGMH or consider subscribing to the podcast for only £2 per month and get ad-free listening and bonus content. You can find links for both on our Facebook and Twitter accounts.
Sounds great, doesn't it?